This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. I'm not quite sure what I'm even supposed to speak about. He said my days at Gottlieb and Milestar, which was a disastrous time period, and then Premier Technology. So what I'd like to try and do is give all of you a sense of what the business was like and what it was like being part of the industry and growing up in the industry. Rob was kind enough, I don't know if you saw the picture that he stuck in the program, but I think it was from 1972, so I don't know where that guy went anymore. I look in the mirror every morning when I shave and it's not the same person. But I got into the industry. I was very fortunate. I started for the Gottlieb Weinberg family in January of 1973. I was hired in November of 72 and started right after the holidays. I wasn't in the engineering. I wasn't in the sales and marketing. I was in the back of the shop because I was hired as what was then called a personnel manager. Today you know it as human resources. The Gottlieb factory was growing. Their goal was to go from 600 employees up to 1,200 within a year. And the reason for that, LA opened up, Chicago opened up, the Italian Attaball market came online, and because of those new markets, the current and existing markets started to expand. The family business was run like any family business. You had close relatives, you had politics, and you had the final say by the boss. So, I was fortunate enough to have two main mentors, or actually three. Wayne Nyans, who unfortunately I understand didn't make it here this year. I don't know if you've met him, but Wayne is one of the greats and one of the few that's still left back from that era. He taught me about pinball and actually taught me how to love the game and how to play it. I eventually got in charge of design, but rest assured, I couldn't design a pinball machine if my life depended on it. So, and by the way, as we're going through this, I don't want to just stand up here and blah, blah, blah all day. So if you have questions about something of that era that I'm talking about at that time, raise your hand. Let's be interactive here so I don't run out of voice and you don't get bored. The other mentor was Judd Weinberg was Judd and Alvin. Judd Weinberg was the son-in-law of David Gottlieb. He had married David's daughter, and Alvin, obviously, the son. I never had the pleasure of meeting David. He had retired and was in ill health when I started, but his tradition of how to run the company and the philosophy of how to treat their employees and their people was important to him, and that was passed on through Alvin. The business side of the business was really taught to me by Judd Weinberg. We had a factory that was about 240,000 square feet. We manufactured everything that went into the electromechanical games in-house, except the silk screening that was done and for both the back glass and the play fields. In about 1974, Gottlieb decided they better catch up with the rest of the industry and get into electronics. Wayne Nyans and I hired a couple of young guys, programmers. One was Alan Edwall, and the other one was Tom DeFotis. They were software engineers, and so we still needed a hardware set. And I think most of you realize that hardware was developed by Rockwell International, and it was manufactured down in Mexicali, Mexico, right across from El Centro. and we had to make several trips down there, and it was completely different than the factory skill sets we're used to. It was completely different than the designers were used to. Just the wiring, Frank Underhill, who used to design all the wiring for Eddie's game, Eddie Krinsky's games, had to learn a whole new skill set. So, excuse me, this was a real transition for both the factory and the engineers. And the Gottlieb family just said, okay, we're behind, let's take it easy, let's just move forward. The largest customer was France. And France said, we don't want electronic games, we still want the old electromechanical. So that's why Gottlieb produced both versions of electromechanical games and electronic games at that time, or solid state. That was then about 1977-78 time frame. Excuse me. Should have opened that before I came up here. Columbia Pictures came into the picture to take over and buy Gottlieb. The nice thing for the Gottlieb family was that they made a lot of money by the sale. The nice thing about for the employees was that we were now part of a much larger company, and the culture of the business stayed the same, because Judd, Alvin, Wayne, Eddie Krinsky, the new electronic guys, the old stable of the industry, the business, stayed on for about 2 years. And then after that, all new management, now not 50%, 60%, but the top guy came in as a new person to the industry, and that was Bob, I can't remember his name, he didn't last very long, but he came in and ran it like a big corporation. And in the pinball business, it's a cottage industry. It may have been some very large financial numbers, but when it boiled down to it, the designing of the game, the creative side of it, and the manufacturing of it really was a small industry. The big three were here in Chicago, Bally, Williams, Gottlieb. So they tried to run it like a big company, and that didn't work too well. They were still making some good money because the games were pretty good. And then Columbia Pictures was sold to Coca-Cola. At that point, everything changed. I was very fortunate. I had been moving along, people who liked me at the company, and I got to be part of Coca-Cola and go down to their marketing and learn how they marketed product, and that's how we were going to hopefully bring some of those traits and skill sets into the pinball industry. Bob Smith, who was the vice president of operations, had retired at that point. I was given his title, and then by the time Coca-Cola came along, I was vice president of marketing. And we went to a meeting in April, I believe it was, of 1983, where all of Coca-Cola's subdivisions and different companies had to meet for a corporate meeting. I was quite impressed. It was out in Phoenix, and you know, they had limos bringing us into the meetings, and we had all these five-year strategies being developed and presented. And after the 3 days, 4 days out there at the meeting, got back. I went to one of the other VPs in the manufacturing area, and I said, we've got a problem. We don't fit what Coca-Cola wants, so somewhere down the road, they're going to get rid of us. And at that point, Boyd Brown was the president. He came out of Mattel. And I went to Boyd and I said, if you ever get the direction to sell the company, I'd be extremely interested in buying it. And he sort of laughed. He says, where are you going to get the money? I said, I don't know. I'll worry about that when the time comes. Well, it was then about 13, 14 months later, it was told to a few of us, which at that point there was Howie Rubin working there, Frank Ballew, and I don't know if you know who all these people are, because some of them came out of the video side of it. And they were developing video games, the Mach 3, which was a very popular video game, and the first laser game, which was also the first one that didn't work, because none of them worked with consumer, right, see? Yeah, you put them in a dirty arcade like on Broadway in New York City, and the laser disc got all messed up, and the games therefore didn't work. But in the summer of 80 through 84, I guess this would be, got word that Gottlieb was, or at that point, it had already been called Milestar. Like I said, I don't know why they ever changed the name. It had to do with something with the flying horse that you see on the Columbia Pictures logo or something or other with a star and all that. I don't remember even. They used an outside marketing firm to come up with the name, which meant nothing to this industry. So we got word that the company was going to be put on the chopping block. So that's when I went back and reminded Boyd that I about my conversation. And since I was under contract, I was very fortunate to be under contract. They couldn't just totally ignore me. They were going to have to pay me for a while anyway. So they thought, okay, we'll go ahead and work out a deal. They said, where are you going to get the money? I said, well, I'll be back. And I flew to New York. And I went to the Empire State Building where Mondial Group, Seren Fezjan, who was my largest exporter to France, had his offices. And it took about 15, 20 minutes of our normal good mornings, how are yous? And then I said, Seren, we got a problem. You're going to not have a product because the company's going out of business and I'm not going to have a job. So why don't you lend me the money, and that way I'll buy it, and I'll produce a product for you. You'll continue your product, and I'll have a job. He said, I got a better idea. He says, we'll buy it together. I didn't mind that, because then I didn't have to pay the money back. So it worked out quite well that we became partners, 50-50, and that's when Premier Technology came into existence in October of 84.
So yeah. Your name or his name?
The name actually, it was a joint. We thought about different names. We wanted to be number one, which we weren't. Gottlieb product was had been driven down during the Milestar era, and so we threw out a bunch of different names. We came up with Premier because we wanted to be number one. We figured it was a top pinball machine. And we happened to check the registration in the state of Illinois, and it wasn't used. So we registered the name. And we still produce the brand name of the Gottlieb pinball under the Premier technology. Yeah?
It's more of a comment than anything else. I play music as well as pinball. But you're probably aware of this, having been under the Columbia umbrella, but they bought Fender Instruments as well, and they had a similar trajectory, but in their case, the corporate oversight changed the product. So if you're ever buying vintage instruments, you always see what it says pre-CBS. similar thing, I guess, where they were just acquiring, but it didn't always fit.
Yeah, the problem with large corporations acquiring successful businesses like that is they have a tendency over a period of time to change the culture and take away the freedom of the creative side. whether it be on any instrument or whether it be in a pin game or a video game. You see that even today. I mean, most of the successful technology companies are those that give their designers the latitude, even though they may be billion-dollar companies, they understand the creative juices and how they flow and what motivates them. Apple and Samsung and companies along those lines all show that. But back in the day of these type of acquisitions, what happened was most of the companies that were the acquirers, such as Columbia Pictures, were run by bean counters, financial people, and all they knew were the numbers side of it. They didn't know the other side of it. Don't misunderstand me. The numbers are important, because if you're not making money when you're in business, you don't last in business very long. But they shouldn't be the driving force. They should be a control factor. So we started Premier, and we really didn't have a backlog of games that could do anything in the marketplace. So our strategy at that point was, we're going to take some of the older games and simplify everything, not go after Epstein's arcade market, because Williams and Bally owned that, not Epstein's, but the market. And we're going to go strictly for the bar to begin with. Let's go to the bar business. Person who's had a few beers standing in a bar isn't really worried about all these rules, and that was our outlook. And it was successful at the beginning. We knew eventually we'd have to try and catch up to the more sophisticated games, and for a while we did, and the market was taking off and so forth, and so we were really riding high, if you will. So was Bally, so was Williams. Then the 90s, 94, 95 time frame, everything started backing down again, and we thought, well, we'll get into another market. And we bought a small company out on the East Coast in the video lottery business, got licensed in North Dakota or South Dakota, got licensed in Louisiana, got licensed in Oregon, and we were going to make video pokers in addition to our pinball machines, and it was going to be a cash cow. The problem was, with the contract that we had in Oregon, we had committed to the, I think it was 1,500 was the opening order, 1,500 units, and we had committed to all of the material, the cabinets, the boards, the electronics, the monitors, all that, and the company we had bought, apparently Oregon felt that they were connected to the East Coast family, crime family, which tainted the contract that we had, tainted our company name, and they canceled the contract, which, as I said before, financials are important, and this is where it really hurt us. Basically, we had $6 million in obligations that we had to pay, and we knew that with the pinball market going down, we paid those obligations, or the majority of them, and decided to sell off everything and get out of the business. I've been very fortunate, as I mentioned earlier, with knowing Wayne Nyans and Johnny Buras, who were some of the key designers, John Osborne, who I think was the one that, I can't remember the gentleman's name who brought me the concept of, it's the one with the lower play field, Black Hole. I can't remember his name, so I apologize to if you... Huh? Okay. And so we bought the concept, and I gave it to Johnny Buras and said, make it into a real pinball machine, because it was basically a great concept, but it wasn't a playing game. And so from there, we went and did Haunted House, which was John Osborne, which was the next one. I said, if two levels are great, three has to be better. And and that's how we got into that. But you know, games that we did at Premier. I mean, John Norris with Cue Ball Wizard, and the guys in the, you know, Alan Edwell was there as at Premier. Most of the engineers came over. Craig Beyerwaltz on the sound. And it was just a great experience. I mean, we had a sound recording studio, so we did all our own voiceovers, and the development of the games. If you've never experienced it, it's hard to convey how exciting and how much fun it really is. It's a lot of work. Don't misunderstand me. These engineers and designers, you know, they mentioned Python earlier in the previous seminar, you know, they were a little off center, but you had to be successful, because they created the ideas and the concepts for us to play and enjoy and be entertained. So I got 15 minutes. It's 10:30 to 11, huh? Oh, okay. Well, I wish you'd have told me that earlier. Now I don't know what to talk about. Questions? Good. Thank you.
Were you the person in charge of licensing during Premier?
Well, I was the president and 50% owner of the company. Okay, so was I in charge of it? I have to take final responsibility, either for success or failure. So I don't know which way you're going with your question, but I will tell you that the person who primarily, there was our vice president of sales at one point, was a gentleman by the name of Jeff Walker. And all the backlight, you know, Hollywood Heat, Raven, those games, those were not licensed games. So he was using the success of what other companies were marketing, and we took those without a license. When we really got into licensing, it was LJ Green. She was with Williams, and LJ, Lori Jane was her, everybody knew her as LJ. She came over to Premier and handled all of the licensing and so forth. The Shaq, the Big Hurt, Super Mario actually was more because of our relationship, knowing the people at Nintendo. So she handled the details of it, but that actually came. And same with Street Fighter. The president of Capcom and myself had known each other for years, so that's how we got into Street Fighter. So does that give you an idea? There were other questions. Yes?
You mentioned that Gatlin had a 240,000 square foot manufacturing plant, did everything up in the plate building, so it's creating the backplates. Did they fabricate cabinets on site at that time?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Cabinets were done, August Johnson was the cabinet manufacturer at Gottlieb. When Premier took over, August Johnson had already gone out of the business, and we were dealing with Electronic Sound, which was Larry Rosenzweig. Larry did the cabinets. Ad Poster did all the silk screening and everything. Well, Ad Poster had gone sort of by the wayside, and so we talked to Larry Rosenzweig had said, Larry, if you want our cabinet business, you also have to learn how to do silk screening at playfields. You're doing a playfield, so now you're going to do it complete. And that's where the silk screening started over at Electronic Sound. Yeah.
At what point was the decision, games like Haunted House, I think, if I recall correctly, had Gottlieb on the back glass and not Premier, wasn't it? Or am I wrong?
Well, that was a Gottlieb game. No, we weren't. No, that was... That was still under Gottlieb, because that was, I don't remember the exact year, 82? Okay. And Premier didn't come into existence till 84.
Rob. I have a question. When I first started Expo, Steve Epstein knows this, some of the old timers, but Gottlieb was very protective of everything. They wouldn't let their employees mingle with other companies. So how was Pinball Expo allowed to tour the factory? When we asked that question way back when, we were almost shocked that they agreed to do it because they were this protective shield around the company, as you know. What happened?
At what year was that?
Well, we were there. Who's the old time? Where's Sandwich? Dave, what year do we go to Premier? You remember? Had it been the late 80s?
You just answered your own question. It wasn't Gottlieb. It was Premier. And that's why I was leading, because you started in 85, Premier started in 84. So it was my decision to allow it. The original philosophy of the Gottlieb family and the Weinberg family was, we're a competitive business. We don't want anything being conveyed to our competition, William or Bally. And they were pretty competitive or quiet too. Maybe a little bit more open than Gottlieb. So when you guys wanted to come in and see the factory, I knew that you hadn't seen the Gottlieb factory. We were trying to get our name as established as possible, so it was good for you and your group, and it was good for us as a company at the time. So that's how it happened. Yes, Mr. Epstein.
I'm curious. You've been part of mine for many years that when big corporations came in to the art industry, that this 90-day cycle of producing numbers for the stockholders became the driving force rather than the creative part of it that suffered because everyone was under a cycle of time where, you know, you have a creative effort. How do you put that into a 90-day cycle? So I've always thought that was really the beginning of the end of what really manufacturing and pinball.
And not only manufacturing. Take your side of it, the operating side, the arcade on Broadway there. That you had to now compete with the chains, and they had the buying power. Although you had to compete with them even before the big companies, but I mean Bally's operations, you had to compete with them. So it put. The large corporations saw profits and a growing business. I mean, when you go from 600 employees to 1,200 employees in 1 year, and your sales basically doubled during that time frame, and it didn't only double for Godley, but doubled for Williams, it doubled for Bally, these new markets opening up. So the large corporations before, when it was a cottage industry and a family industry, didn't pay any attention to it. Now, the reason Columbia Pictures bought Gottlieb is because they thought it was a constant cash, free cash flow company, which is really crazy because it was no different than Columbia Pictures. You made a game, if it was successful, you made a lot of money. If it was a dog, you ate a lot of money, and you try for your next one. It was the same thing in the movie industry, only they didn't realize, they thought it was a manufacturer, therefore it was more consistent. So as they started getting in, Gottlieb at its height, oh, by the way, that 240,000 square feet, that was just the one facility. We had an 80,000 square foot in Bensonville and another 20,000 square feet in Fargo, North Dakota. The build rate per day was over 1,200 pinball machines in 1 day. I mean, I haven't been in the industry. I was here last year and stopped in for about an hour just to see one machine. But I haven't been in the industry since 97. And so to see what's going on now, a grassroots movement and the collectors have been really the true market, from when it was a very high profile business to through the downtimes and now. And you're getting more business in home market. We never used to sell to the home. The operator, the street operator primarily, he had his ABC machines. He would, the A machine was the new and latest and greatest, and that one is top locations. It stayed there for a period of time and then rotated to his B locations. And then his C location, or he sold it to a smaller operator, and the D location was he sold it to the home. So that's how he, the operator, turned his inventory over. And moving it from top, second, third tier, and then eventually to the home. Well, now new games are going to the home. Some of the prices they're getting now, if I could have gotten those, I'd probably still be in business. But there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. I'm not saying they're not worth it. Come back to you in a minute. Yes. Yeah, I mean, we took the games that were, when we bought the company, we took the games that were in production and developed at that point. That's what, and we took them. They had built some at the original or the Gottlieb factory, and then shut down. All right. Then in October of '84 was when we inked the deal, so we really didn't. I'm trying to think. I think it was. It took us about 6 weeks to move and set up all the lines over into the Bensonville facility instead of the North Lake, where Gottlieb original or major main plant was, because we kept the one in Bensonville, which was the 80,000 square feet, and the 20,000 in Fargo, North Dakota. We bought those two facilities. So whatever was in process, we just picked it up, moved it to the other factory, set up all new lines, and made it there. We farmed out all of the stampings. We didn't take any of the metal stamping equipment, the presses and so forth, and spot welders. We said there's enough companies in Chicago that do that, so we'll just move that out. But those designs and the in the WIP, the inventory that was in process, we just moved over, continued to manufacture that, and keep going. So. That's how that happened, why they had both names. Yes, sir.
Do you have any stories or good memories around the material, like dealing with celebrities or just something?
Oh, we had some.
The Gottlieb exterminator game was done during the later years where apparently it was already. Did you guys do that, or was that?
I don't remember when Exterminator was done. If you can tell me the date, I can tell you which company did it. If it was the later 80s, it was Premier. Yeah, I mean, some of the license. You asked about the licensing. One of the games that we did that was my favorite was Shaq Attack, Shaquille O'Neal. And so part of the licensing deal was that Shaquille got one of the games for his home. Made sense. Well, this was his first year at Orlando playing professional ball, or second year. And so we go to deliver the game because we figure if he's getting a game for the home, we're going to get some press out of it. So we got the cameras and our PR people working on it and all this. And we go down to deliver the game. And we're going to do a photo shoot there. Matter of fact, I think, I'm not real active on Facebook, but I'm on there, and LJ Green, who I mentioned earlier, she posted one of the pictures of a group of us at Shaq's house. So we go in, and these are like a bunch of college students. There's Pete's, I mean, it's a multi-million dollar house, and he's got a huge game room that's probably about half the size of this room here, and he's got his buddies from the Orlando Magic. They're all standing around in the kitchen eating pizza, waiting for us. So, and he was a great guy. I mean, he did terrific things with the photo shoot and all of that. Frank Thomas, the Big Hurt, when we introduced that game to our distributors, he gave us a skybox at the Sox game to do the introduction, have all our distributors there, and then we did at Planet Hollywood in Chicago a press release. It was on all the news stations. So, I mean, yeah, I've got some great memories of that kind of thing. When I was a kid growing up, I loved baseball, and I always thought I was very good until I got to college and found out how good baseball players really are. But one of the thrills of my life, we did a national tie-in with prevention of child abuse through the Manufacturers Association, and I got to stand at home plate at the old Yankee Stadium and present Don Mattingly with a plaque for appreciation for him participating in that as a national chairman. I got invited to the White House with Barbara Bush, who was the national chairman, and there was 25 different industries, and I was fortunate enough to be the president of the Manufacturers Association at that time to represent our industry, again, for the prevention of child abuse. And she was our national, excuse me, national campaign leader. So we had a tea at the White House with her. And if her husband could speak as well as she did, he probably would have won a second term. But a fabulous lady. So I've got this business has given me the opportunity to meet people that I normally would never have met. It's given me, because it was a worldwide business, go to places that most people never get to go. I mean, I've been to Australia so many times, and it's a terrible flight. It's just long. But I've been down there 12, 13 times, I don't know. 70% of the pinball business was outside North America. So France, Germany, all the Western European countries, many of the Eastern blocs opened up, Hungary, Romania, excuse me. So we get, the Far East, you get to go everywhere. Yeah.
Why do you think that you have been so successful in France, especially? Why was this the most important, especially for Bundy?
Two reasons. Seren Fezjan was a very unique individual. Seren Fezjan was Armenian, born in Turkey, grew up in France, and during World War II was part of the French underground. Obviously, he was older than I am. So, but he then, because of his political connections, was in a very strong position business-wise within the country of France. He had an office in Paris and another one in Marseille. So his distribution channels were because of his political connections, and Gottlieb, therefore, was the first to really get into the French market. So when you said flipper, is what they called them there, not pinball machines, you were talking about a Gottlieb. Unfortunately, Gottlieb didn't hold that forever because Williams really came in strong. Bally, I don't think, ever was number one in France, but Williams eventually knocked Gottlieb off the top of the totem pole there. But it was really the channel of distribution and the introduction to the market there. Yeah.
I'm from Fargo, so I'm curious what you produced there and where was the factory?
The factory was actually in West Fargo, and we did all of our wiring harnesses there. You know where the old Armor meatpacking plant Center Street. It was out there. We bought one of the buildings we had was part of the original Armour Meatpacking Company that was there in the 40s. And so we had about 15, 20,000 square feet and ran a shift and a half up there. Had 300 employees at one point in Fargo. It was sold. I don't know where it is now. That was 15 years ago. So, I'm sorry?
Have any games?
No. I'm an empty nester, so I've downsized. When my kids were growing up, our rec room looked like an arcade. I even had a Humpty Dumpty and a baffle ball. All of that's gone. I now live in a townhouse, so I don't have the, we still have plenty of room, but not for an arcade, and I don't need it for an arcade. Now, my son, on the other hand, and my nephew both have games in their rec rooms, and they continue to, my son keeps buying, he just bought, what was the one, a Wizard of Oz that came out last year.
What is your favorite game?
My favorite game? You have to break it down by era. I loved Royal Flush, and it electromechanical game that was my favorite one. From the Premier era, I really loved Shack Attack. I liked the basket shot and so forth. For the some people have told me they like Haunted House better. I actually preferred Black Hole. Haunted House got a little too cluttered after I really thought about it, from my opinion. Cue Ball Wizard. Is your partner here?
No.
Oh, okay. Then I won't. I was going to say Brooks and Dunn was a good game, but nobody ever got to see that. It is. Is it? I don't know.
I have one more question for you, go, because we need to get going here. But did you ever attempt to hire any Williams or Bally employees?
Well, we did hire Williams and Bally employees.
Designers,
designers.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I tried. I wasn't successful. Is Pat here? Yeah, no, he's not here. He's later on today.
Yeah.
And also, Lamar's the one that I don't understand why he went to Williams. He grew up with the Gottliebs in Oak Park.
Who's this?
Larry DeMar.
Oh, Larry DeMar. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
He's a close friend of the Gottlieb family, and yet he ends up at Williams. I don't know how Alvin let that happen.
Good. Hey, Dave, last question.
Joe Kamikow. He went to Premier at one point?
Yes.
Yeah. What game he was working on?
Hell, I am this. No, I don't. You know what?
Was he a designer?
That's one of the pro.
Was he a designer?
Yeah. Yeah, Joey was a designer. And in Joey's defense, the best thing that happened to him is he left there. Because he's been very successful ever since he left.
You can ask my question at the banquet. He'll be the banquet. You can ask
yeah.
my question.
Yeah, I don't know. You know. It's funny, you guys probably know individual games or times better than I do, because as you're building a game, you're thinking about it, but you're also worried about the next game and selling the one that's coming off the line and making sure that you've got enough parts and so forth. So, not that I... And plus, as I get older, my memory's not as good as it used to be. So, some of these all sort of blend together.
Quick question. Do you remember an employee named Norm Clark? Not the one that worked with Williams as the designer, but the one that got
him, who
wasn't the designer.
I've heard the name, but I think he was gone before 72. I think. I don't remember meeting him. But I know there was a Norm Clark that did work at Gottlieb. I thought he worked along with Frank Underhill, which.
Engineering?
wiring harnesses engineering, that kind of design or drafting, that kind of stuff. I'm not positive, though.
Let me sum up by saying this. This is another speaker that said, maybe I could talk for 20 minutes. Well, it's been almost 50 minutes. I'm now going to kick you off the stage, but we thank you so much for being with us. You did a great job.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.